As rains have Holly, KC9RP and the crew are preparing for their 29th sojourn to the Dayton Hamvention, it seems prudent to give the guys and gals a couple of weeks off. So in their absence, we're going to replay the most requested rain report podcast ever. We go back to March 2016 for the rain replay of a two-part interview with a gentleman whose coast-to-coast broadcast was the biggest syndicated show heard after dark across the United States in the 90s. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, with part one of a rare glimpse into the life of Art Bell, W6OBB.
I had a blast when I was a kid. To my mother's dismay, I think she thought I was overdoing it. I'm sure I was. But ham radio is what led me into broadcast radio.
Art's coast-to-coast AM nighttime broadcast was heard on more than 500 radio stations nationwide at its peak in the 1990s. According to Wikipedia, his topics ranged from the paranormal, the occult, UFOs, proto-science, and pseudoscience. Art was recently interviewed by Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, for his QSO Today weekly podcast. We have condensed Eric's hour-long conversation with Art into two 15-minute parts for you. Here's part one.
When I was about 11 or 12, I would go to my grandma's house, and she had this old, I'd had to stand 5 feet up, old radio, and it covered the shortwave bands, not sideband, which we didn't even have then, actually, but just AM shortwave. And I would listen around, I'd hear other countries, and I thought it was magic. So I became more and more interested. I finally ran into a fellow who lived down the street from me. This was in Pennsylvania at the time. He actually, believe it or not, was a nuclear scientist. However, he in his basement had a full setup and would entice me by having me come over and sit and watch him talk to Europe and around the world. I was hooked. I mean, I was hook, line, and sinker hooked. So he slowly trained me to become a novice, and I took my test. My first rig was a Heathkit AT1 transmitter, which was crystal controlled and good for about 30 watts on a good day. And so I got on, and that's how it happened. I think I was licensed either late 12 or early 13. That's all I did. I would sit in my room, and I would operate day and night. It's strange because I don't really like CW, but it came easily to me. I'm one of those people, I guess.
Do you remember what the receiver was?
Sure. The AC3.
Also a Heathkit.
Yeah, that's right. I can tell you a funny little story about that. I, of course, needed a receiver. I got the transmitter, then needed a receiver. So I ordered that from Heathkit. I was not what you would call a technician at that point. In other words, I didn't know a lot of technical stuff. So when I got the Heathkit, I got all the parts out like everybody does, didn't read the instructions the way I was supposed to, Eric. And so I didn't know that I was supposed to shorten lead length. My assumption was that all capacitors and resistors had to be the length they were given to me as. So I didn't shorten any lead lengths. Now, I built the entire thing, and you can well imagine capacitors and resistors were sticking out like spaghetti from the bottom. I had built it correctly, with that exception. So when I finally proudly slid this thing into its case and turned on the power, it sort of caught on fire. Because as you can imagine, all the resistors and capacitors meshed together. It was a pretty big disaster. So I finally realized the error of my ways. I redid the whole thing, and God bless, it worked.
And what kind of antenna did you use on your novice rig?
Yeah, these really are things you never forget. It was just a long wire, a 65-foot long wire. The Heathkit AT1 lent itself to a long wire antenna. You know, there was one screw there, and that was it.
Oh, on the output. No coax output on that.
Oh,
that
no. Radio. No. Not that I recall. Maybe there was, but I don't recall it. I just recall a single wire attachment point. I used a long wire in the beginning.
And do you remember what your first call sign was?
Oh, sure. Who would ever forget that? KN3JOX, licensed in Media, Pennsylvania. That really brings back memories. So KN3JOX became K3JOX as I obtained my general. I became W2CKS. Got very lucky when I'm into the 2 area. I got a pretty good call, W2CKS. Then finally, as an adult, I wanted to live on the west coast of the U.S., so away I went. I believe I sent a letter with my license, and I begged to get a W call because I had been lucky enough to get one in the 2 call area. So I literally begged the FCC. And sure enough, they came back, believe it or not, and gave me W6OBB. And I have had that ever since. We're talking about from the age of 12 or 13 to 70. Never not been a ham. Never not had a rig that was working and operable.
When did you upgrade to extra class?
What happened is I was a general. I then, in San Diego, California, as I mentioned, I went to the West Coast, took the advanced class. And I became an advanced for a lot of years. And then finally, when the commission came out with the new allocations, the extras were given so much more bandwidth on bands that I love, like 75 meters. I finally was pushed over the edge and went and took my extra and passed it.
After the first mentor that you had in Pennsylvania, did you have any other Elmers or mentors?
When we'd be riding down the street, and by that I mean when I would be in my mom's car and we'd be headed somewhere, I would typically see an antenna and I'd go, "Mom, stop, stop." And we'd stop at the antenna and I would go and knock on the door and I'd meet the ham, and inevitably, whoever it was would hand me some piece of equipment that he didn't want anymore and say, "God bless you, son. See you later." Little things, clocks, occasionally and another rig of one sort or another. I think I had a Hallicrafter's receiver that only changed frequency slightly when you touched the desk. So I don't know about mentors, but donations I did receive. I slowly moved up in the world. I think I went pretty much through the Heathkit line, Eric. I went from a AT1 to a DX20, a DX40, a DX60, and then finally an Apache. I love the Apache. It was plate modulated, sounded like $1 million. So that takes you pretty quickly through my early days. I couldn't afford a lot. I was on the air every day, mostly all day, to my mother's dismay, enjoying myself. I have always loved lower bands, 75 and 40, because, you know, you can kind of hook up with people that you met the day before or last week and pretty reliably know that you'll be talking to them again and meet up with them on the band. I also, as a young ham, operate an awful lot of the higher bands. As I do today, I operate all bands.
Because it sounds to me like your parents were quite supportive of your hobby. They might have complained that maybe you were infatuated with it. Mine did. What kind of impact did amateur radio have and still have on your family life?
I guess my ham hobby has impacted all my life. I've had a couple of families. There was never a time that I didn't devote one room of whatever abode I was in to amateur radio. And that includes today. I'm sitting in the shack right now. It's impacted my family life always. My mom was afraid that it would lead to no good things for me. Quite to the contrary, it led to my eventual career. I had a blast when I was a kid. To my mother's dismay, I think she thought I was overdoing it. I'm sure I was. But ham radio is what led me into broadcast radio.
You're listening to the thoughts of Art Bell, W6OBB, former host of Coast to Coast AM, a nighttime radio show that was heard on over 500 stations nationwide and boasted a nightly audience of 15 million listeners in the 1990s. Art was recently interviewed by Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, for his QSO Today podcast. We'll resume Eric's conversation with Art after I remind you that these rain reports are available on demand from therainreport.com, at The Rain Report on Twitter, and via iTunes. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
I found that as I entered my career in broadcasting, Eric, and I know it's rushing you a little bit to get you there already, but what I found is that I got eternal connections. In other words, amateur radio is kind of a brotherhood. Once you walk in a place and you're applying for a job or something like that, and the other fellow mentions that he's a ham, you can almost know it's a lock. I mean, not absolutely, but the brotherhood has always taken care of its own, Eric, and it certainly took care of me. I was only 13 years old, toward the end of 13, when I finally went and got a commercial first-class radio telephone license. So I went from ham radio and never left ham radio, not one day in all these years, and then I entered the broadcast realm. And I did so pretty much in engineering, but quickly moved on to on-the-air work. And I'm telling you, Eric, and this is truth, and I suspect it's still pretty much true today, that if you mention you're a ham, and the guy sitting across the desk from you is a ham, you've probably got a lock on the job. Ham radio has served me all my life. It's not just a hobby. It's an absolute love. I have a limited formal education, some college. I don't think it propelled me toward a further educational goal of some sort. I wanted to get in radio, Eric, and by radio, I mean commercial broadcasting. We moved around a lot as I was a child. My mom and dad were both Marines. My mother was one of the first women Marines in the country. She was a drill instructor, if you can believe that, at Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. My dad was a retired colonel from the Marine Corps, and I was born on Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. You can imagine I had fairly strict parents. At any rate, I began going to hang out as much as they would let me at local radio stations, meeting the disc jockeys, meeting the engineers, going ooh and ah at 300-400, I guess it was, transmitters, digging into stuff and just doing everything I could at a radio station, whether it was engineering or it was air work or bringing somebody their coffee, what have you. I did that endlessly as a child.
Well, we've had a number of guests on the QSO Today podcast who were engineers at radio stations as kids, because the kids with a first-class license walks in the door and he's got the job. But not many of them end up on the air, except maybe because there's a spot in the middle of the night to fill. The station manager says, well, why don't you fill it, read the news. How did you end up on the air?
Well, I'm laughing because that ultimately is exactly how I ended up with my big career in radio. Somebody who said, well, I guess we're going to have to put you on at night. I started, as I mentioned, to finally get jobs. You know, I guess I had a decent voice, and I landed a job at a little FM religious station in Franklin, New Jersey. And to get to work, I had to climb this mountain. I mean, it was literally on the mountain. Instead of just putting the antenna on the mountain, the whole thing was there. It was a religious FM station, Eric, and all I did was read the news every hour. But I stayed there full time to do it. The man who owned and ran this station was of an unusual sort. He had a thing about people who get too close to the microphone. He liked my news, but he thought I got too close to the mic. So in the middle of a 5-minute newscast, he would walk into the studio, grab the back of the chair, and yank it out from under me. And right on the air, you would hear me take a tumble onto the floor, and he'd start ranting at me. Needless to say, I didn't stay for a long time at that FM station, but that's kind of start I had, rough start, I guess I had. And then from that point, I was looking toward, you know, I'm a kid, so I'm looking toward rock and roll radio, and I did secure some jobs at some rock stations. I'm talking about Top 40 here. It did pretty well, actually did pretty well. And then I finally said, ah, the heck with this. I'm going to go in the Air Force. So I took a break from everything, went into the Air Force, all set for a radio career. They said, no, it looks like you're going to go into, brace yourself, Eric, medicine. So I became a medic. I went to Amarillo Air Force Base after basic training in San Antonio and was a medic, and then made my way to the Far East. Inevitably, you can guess the years, touched down in Okinawa, spent a lot of time on Okinawa, of course, Vietnam, the Philippines, and spent a lot of time in the Far East. Now, when I left the Air Force, I did 4 years and out, I had fallen in love with the island of Okinawa. The Ryukyu Islands were administered by the U.S. Eric, and there was a commercial broadcast station owned by an Okinawan company, Ryukyu Hoso, actually. They had a rock and roll station that served the GIs on the island. At that time, that was about 250,000 if you included the dependents. I wrote them a letter. I got an answer, and they said, come on to Okinawa. We're going to pay your way, and you can do air work. And so I spent a total of 10 years, Eric, on the island of Okinawa.
Were you also the station engineer as well as the on-air talent?
No. That was all Okinawans. But it was quite an experience. I remember we had an old teletype machine in a little soundproof room. And the only way that one could get news would be to pick it up by radio. I think there were two or three different frequencies, but it came from the U.S. by radio. If you can imagine the selective fading that was coming from California, where the signal was coming from all the way to Okinawa, typically halfway through a story, it would go into a selective fade and you would have complete garble. You couldn't just run into this little room and rip. You had to read as well. If you didn't read, you'd get halfway through a story and it'd go in total garble. So that's how we got our news from the Associated Press halfway across the world.
Do you remember the station call letters?
Sure. KSBK, Kilowatt Sugar Bravo Kilowatt. I was a ham there, of course. I was a ham everywhere. I was KR6BK. I took very nearly nothing to Okinawa and bought the rig that I wanted, which at that time I believe was a Tempo. I lived in a little Japanese house with, at that time, a cute little Japanese girl. And I constructed my antenna on the roof from bamboo. My brilliant idea, Eric, was to take long sections of bamboo and cover them with aluminum foil, which worked very well. You can create dipoles from that. You can create beams from that. You can do a whole lot, Eric, with bamboo and aluminum foil. That's the way I operated for any number of years as KR6BK on the island of Okinawa. And those were pretty good condition times. You could typically work any day you wanted into California, no problem at all.
And that concludes our first of two excerpts from a recent conversation between Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, and Art Bell, W6OBB, host of the Coast to Coast call-in radio show that dominated nighttime radio nationwide in the 90s. So how and where did Coast to Coast AM get started? And what is the story behind the big red button he never pushed, but almost did numerous times? These vexing questions and more will be answered in part two of Art Bell, His Story, here on The Rain Report. If you simply can't wait for the answers, you'll find Eric's hour-long conversation with Art on QSOtoday.com. If you're going to the Hamvention May 19th through the 21st at its new home in Xenia, Ohio, be sure to drop by booth 6603 and chat with Rain founder-producer Hap Holly, KC9RP. And if you have 220 handy, try us on 224.06 simplex, no PL. That's 224.06. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2017. Rain. All rights are reserved. Now for Hap Holly, KC9RP, Rain's founder-producer, I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR, bidding you very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network. Available for transmission over amateur radio from therainreport.com, on Twitter at TheRainReport, and via iTunes.
Keep on hamming.